Welcome back to Switchcast Season 5. I'm your host, Doug Tabbitt, here with my co-host, Tyler Sanders, also the executive associate producer. And
really excited, guys. This is a new position for me. Really opens a lot of doors. It's going to be a good day.
It's an arbitrary title. Similar assistant to the regional producer.
I already got new business cards.
Executive producer Ethan Huffnagel over to my left off camera here, but occasionally we'll throw in some banter or questions. Anyway, we're the automotive news and entertainment show that's not just for car people. We seek to entertain, edify, and educate you on the drive of your life. And if you are enjoying this podcast, please help us out with the algorithms. Hit that like button, share, subscribe, tell your friends. The old Eminem thing, Shady's back. Switchcast's back. Tell your friends. Anyway, the All reason right. I don't rap. And also support our wonderful sponsors, Switch Cars, Sheffield Watches, and Nuts for Sticks. The show is free for you because of their generosity. Tonight, we are talking about a little bit of a more serious subject. A Lamborghini Huracan wreck at a very high speed, and it did claim a life. So it's a little bit of a sensitive topic here, but I think it's something worth talking about and unpacking because we are car people and we own fast cars, and most of you listening probably do. We enjoy driving. Driving is not necessarily safe or innocent, regardless of the speed that we're traveling. There's 40,000 plus or minus deaths on U.S. highways every year, which is a giant, giant number. So I think this stuff matters, you know, why these accidents happen, what we can learn from them, especially as car guys. Is it just a matter of, well, slow down? Or is it more than that? I think accident investigations and statistics and what the media says about them is important as well, because you can certainly build a narrative off of something that is not necessarily accurate. In this particular scenario, Christopher Rossi out of Kirtland Hills, Ohio, back in July, was driving a 2023 Lamborghini Huracan STO on Route 322. We may know it locally as Mayfield Road in Geauga County. That is a two-lane road. The speed limit out there is typically 45 to 55. It's a, you know, it's a good road, but it's not an open highway. There are traffic lights. There are intersections. There's schools and businesses and stuff like that. The farther east you get, there's a lot of Amish people in their buggies. So you have to be really, really heads up and aware of what's out there. And there's, unfortunately, a lot of fatal accidents with the Amish buggies as well, because you know, they got little tiny flashing lights and an orange triangle on the back of them typically, and, you know, low visibility, and they get hit, and there's definitely no crumple zones there. So, you know, all that to say, this is not an area where, you know, you could do a cannonball or something like that. This is not a three-lane highway, right? There's a time and a place. So anyway, he was traveling at a high rate of speed, according to all reports, had just gone through an intersection, which is important given the speeds. And according to the accident report, somebody had pulled out of their driveway, not pulled out in front of him. They were firmly established in their lane and traveling. And he swerved to go around them because of his speed. And at that point, lost control and hit some landscaping in front of a business, went airborne, landed, like flipped and landed in a storage building, and the vehicle caught fire. The driver, Chris, was ejected from the vehicle and passed away from his injuries. The passenger was trapped inside the vehicle at the time of the accident. He was transported to the hospital for his injuries. And according to what I found on Facebook, the passenger has made a full recovery and is back to work. But something that was also frustrating for me is when this happened, there was tons of news articles everywhere, right? I mean, it's relevant. We're guilty of the same thing. Something exciting happens. We want to get on what's trending, what people are searching for. We want to be relevant. We want to talk about what's hot at that moment. But there's a fundamental flaw in media outlets is that they do that, and that's fine, but there's never any follow-up. There's no deeper dive. There's no, okay, what happened? What happened to the passenger? You can't even find his name anywhere online. Not that it's necessarily relevant to anyone that's not involved, but you know, there's no follow-up of, well, what did the accident investigation say? Why did this really happen, other than, well, it was a Lamborghini going too fast? And I feel like all that does is set people against rich people in fast cars or fancy cars. They're all just reckless and endangering all of us. And it's continuing this narrative that we're all just a danger to society and everybody in a Toyota Camry is just safe and benign, and the world and the roads out there would be a better place if it wasn't for all these people in bright blue Lamborghinis speeding.
Yeah. And, you know, I think we've talked about this a couple of times, and I even pulled up some articles to refresh myself because I remember talking about this when it happened, you know, amongst friends, and there is no follow-up. There is no nothing. There's barely even any information. You have to dig pretty far to get further details, some of which Doug has mentioned on the scenario and what had happened. And it's there is, like Doug said, there's a fundamental flaw, and I don't know how to fix it. I don't think we're in the position to fix it, but it makes this pretty challenging because I think this is a complex situation that, because it is a bright blue Lamborghini, on the surface may seem simple to people who have some predisposition to feel a certain way.
Sure.
Both positively and negatively. Not positively about the situation, but both maybe from a car enthusiast perspective, thinking like, it couldn't possibly have been the car's fault, or to somebody who is not an enthusiast thinking, oh, that's just, like you said, some rich guy in a fancy car driving too fast.
Yep. Yep. So thankfully the passenger was not killed. That's the first thing, is whenever anything like this happens, we don't want quote unquote innocent victims. All lives are important, but when somebody makes a stupid decision and reaps the consequence themselves of that stupid decision, it's a consequence versus an innocent victim who had nothing to do with it other than just being on the road. Getting in a car with a guy, well, that's a different judgment decision, you know, whatever. I don't think that the passenger thought about what might happen. But anyway, let's dig into a few more details. So I was able to pull the accident report from the Ohio State Police, who investigated it, and the photos as well. And there's a few things I noticed from the accident report. One, and this may explain some of the lack of media follow-up, there was no extended or formal investigation other than the crash investigation or the crash report from the scene, because there was no charges filed. And I'm assuming that's because there were no other victims, right? There was property damage, et cetera, but the driver was deceased. So like, what are they going to charge him with? There's no point. There's nothing to prosecute. So the accident report itself did not come to a number of conclusions that I would have liked to have seen. The accident report stated that there was evidence of alcohol in the driver's system, or there was a suspicion of alcohol. The accident report did not state the speed that they were traveling. It was just like undetermined. I've heard rumors from law enforcement that it was between 150 and 180 miles an hour.
Oh.
Which, you know, you want to talk about speeding versus I'm going 175, we'll call it, on a two-lane road with intersections. Like, that is just blindingly fast. It doesn't even compute. Like, I think people hear that number and it's so fast that you can't respond to stuff. On a two-lane road, it's one thing to do it on a highway. And even then, like, the times that we got those speeds on a Cannonball was like nobody around and wide open visibility. Like it just, that kind of speed on a two lane road is ridiculous. And they had just gone through an intersection, which intersections are crowned, right? Like, ugh. But the interesting thing to note that I thought was the three different eyewitness reports stated one person said over 90 miles an hour. The other person said 120 miles an hour. The other person said 200 miles an hour. So the inconsistency was wild, which I thought was interesting to note because, you know, people are terrible at estimating speed. But then there was the question of alcohol, right? They didn't do a toxicology test because, again, they didn't do a complete investigation. So we have to go off of witness reports. Now, one of his friends was with him at the bar, and Chris had actually passed this friend right before he wrecked. So they had both left, and his friend said in the report that Chris had had four White Claws in 4 hours at one bar, which seems convenient that essentially the rule of thumb is one drink per hour is within the legal limit.
Yeah.
So obviously I'm not saying that he misremembered or altered the truth or whatever, but I'm just saying that that's convenient that, you know, his friend was the driver. He didn't likely want to throw him under the bus. The problem is there was another eyewitness report, and there's photos of the blue Lamborghini at different bars. And there's another eyewitness report that placed him at a different bar 2 hours prior. So if he had four White Claws in 4 hours at one bar, but he was at a different bar within 2 hours, that already cast shade on the first eyewitness report. So I'm already going, okay, this isn't primarily Speed's fault. Do we know that he was drunk? No, we don't. But it's highly likely that he was not fit to drive, and especially not to drive those kinds of speeds, right? There's a difference between maybe being slightly over the limit and driving the speed limit home. I do not advocate it, but let's be honest. There is a difference between that and the mental acuity required to drive 100 plus miles an hour. There's no mental acuity that excuses 150 plus on a two-lane road, but let's just talk about this honestly, right?
Yeah, and I think it just complicates the story. You know, it complicates maybe what actually happened. I think I've driven that road myself, maybe not this particular part of it, but I, like you've already kind of mentioned, it is a little bit more of a rural area. Visibility is questionable at times, even during the day. You know,
it's a fun road to drive, but I 100%. Don't think I would ever go 100 miles an hour, let alone more than that.
Absolutely.
When I'm
not
ripping it out there, it's like, yeah, like 75, maybe 80 on a straight where I can see stuff, you know, but I'm not, again, there's too many hazards out there. So,
and I think if, you know, there's a potential for a lack of judgment, whether that's caused by a substance or whatever else that kind of has placed the person in the scenario to do this. I guarantee I wouldn't even come close.
Yeah. I recognize the irony of talking about this while we're sitting here having a sip of alcohol, but I think there's a very important point, right? Like speed in and of itself is not good or bad. It's contextual. Alcohol in and of itself is not good or bad. There's people every day all across the world who have a drink or two and drive home safely. There's a reason there is a legal limit, right? It's not 0.00, it's 0.08, right? It's what happens when you take these things to extremes, when you mix them with a situation that you shouldn't.
They're all like different types of risks that when you put enough of them together can lead to varying degrees of bad things.
Yeah.
You know, I think the road is a good consideration there too. This is not, you know, I'm not going to go that speed. That's not, I have the judgment to tell me my skills. I'm not confident in the situation. It's not worth it for me personally, but also not that road.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just no thanks.
Yeah. It's an unfortunate situation all around. It's a bummer that there is not more in-depth investigation into this. We understand why there wasn't. Accidents like this do happen all the time. But I think it's just a matter of judgment on all counts, right? It's really poor judgment to go those kinds of speeds on those roads. It's really poor judgment to go out and have a bunch of drinks and then drive at all, let alone try to show off for your friend. It's really poor judgment to get into a car like that with a friend who's had a couple drinks and or may be prone to show off, right? Like ego plus horsepower do not mix.
No.
Ego plus alcohol plus horsepower really don't mix. It's unfortunate because it could have been avoided, but it wasn't. So there's the follow-up. I wish there was more to dig into, but I think we can still take some things away from this and hopefully all learn. I don't think most of us are making decisions like this on a regular basis. There's a reason this is kind of a freak accident and a big news story. But I think we all can still learn things from it and make better decisions as a result.
Well, and I think, you know, we talk a lot about a lot of the positives of this hobby and what we're enthusiastic about. And there is a lot of negatives to balance that out at times. And I think we just need to be reminded, whether it's by this horrible story or by other means, that our hobby is potentially very dangerous.
Yeah.
If we are not careful, if we do not make good decisions, if we are not skilled, sometimes the situation is, I don't want to say unavoidable, but there's just many things coming together to kind of make it a truly bad scenario like this one. But just keep that in mind when you're going out for a rip with the boys or whatever, is, you know,
sure,
to be mindful of yourself, your surroundings, the other people with you, whether they're in your car or pedestrians.
Yeah.
You know, thankfully no pedestrian was the passenger. Passenger, maybe not pedestrian, but
yeah, nobody outside the car was harmed, other than maybe needing some mental counseling after seeing what went down.
It's just,
and I'm not saying that facetiously, yeah, like that's for real.
It's just never worth it. Gotta be honest.
And like, driving is dangerous, period. All of these factors, whether it's ego, whether it's speed, showing off, alcohol, exacerbate the danger that already exists. I don't think any one of them are actual causes. And of course I'm always defending the speed thing, right? Those are not necessarily the primary causes, but it always gets blamed. But it ultimately comes down to a lack of judgment. And there was a whole bunch of those factors all together in this one. It's just,
yes.
Yeah. 180 miles an hour. It's just nuts.
Yeah, all even right. Some of the less intense speed are crazy.
Crazy.
On that road, I would not. Nope.
On a much lighter note, let's go to our wall of shame for the week. We've modified this a little bit. We've got some interesting love-hate comments directed at us on the internet. Mean tweets, if you will. So our mean tweet of the week, I've renamed the mean tweak. Ethan, what mean tweak do we have this week?
Well, it's a response to an initial comment which asked, why does Tyler look like he sat too close to the fire? I think that's referring to the redness.
Unfortunately, my genetics somewhere mean that if I am like within 5 feet of an alcohol, my face turns bright red. So I got to run what I brung.
We're still working on the lighting in the studio as well, so that may exacerbate.
We're figuring.
I'm wearing
out
more makeup than Tyler.
Wait, you get a makeup budget? We got to.
But what was the other one?
Yeah, so this was the big one here. Was the response to that from another user? Also, what's with the failed beard experiment on his chin?
Oh man,
he's trying out to be a bass guitar player.
See, you can't blame that on being around a alcohol.
Ethan, no, I cannot. This is, again, I got to run what I brung. This is what happens. This is what I can do. You don't want to see it without this here. So, you know, big baby face. I at least look like an adult this way. Nuts for Sticks is a brand celebrating the manual transmission in all its forms. So forget those flappy paddles because we like shifting ourselves. Check out our fun and funny stick themed shirts at nutsforsticks.com and save 10% on your order using the discount code SWITCHCAST. That's nutsforsticks.com and use code SWITCHCAST.
So I got a message recently asking me to find a specific Porsche 993 Turbo.
Seems like a common question for you, I'd imagine.
Sure. Neat color combo, black over red interior, which I thought was cool. And I'm very careful with protecting clients' personal information. We don't, you know, out anybody here on the podcast. However, what I found searching for the car is all public information. So anybody could have gotten there. And it was pretty incredible, the rabbit hole that I traveled down just by trying to find this car.
So, I gotta be honest, you sent me these some links and were like, here's some information. I was like, what the heck am I looking at? I had to read all three of them to figure out what was going on.
Yeah, so I Googled the VIN, I ran the Carfax, pulled up Epic VIN, VIN Wiki, all the usual stuff I do, and I said, oh, well, shoot, that car's here locally. This shouldn't be hard to find. So I went and did an Ohio title search and found that it was owned by a dealership. The dealership had purchased it a number of years ago, though, which was odd. So it was still in their name. It was still an active title. And I looked up the dealer name. And it was a local dealer. I knew the guy. So I called him and said, hey, do you still have this car? He said, oh, yeah, it's my business partner owns it, and it's staying in our personal collection. I was like, okay, well, somebody reached out to me. Their client's looking for it. And he said, oh, well, he called me today too. I said, oh, well, okay, well, he knows you have it. There's no point in me trying to track this down here. I thought this was going to be like this big mystery to uncover, and I'd find this car that nobody else could and whatever. And so I just messaged the guy and said, I'm going to get out of the middle here. There's no sense me getting involved. But
I'm going to say, is the story over? The segment's been going for like 2 minutes.
Yeah. In searching the VIN, I got some really, really interesting results. And one of the first results was a lawsuit, United States of America versus, and the VIN number was listed as a defendant.
What did this car do? Well, unacceptable.
That's the first time I've seen a VIN number listed as a defendant, and not being an attorney or a court person or whatever, it took a bit to unpack what exactly was going on.
This is like straight out of a Pixar movie.
Right. So the best I could determine, and then searching through the court records, of course, I was able to pull up people's names and LLC's names and then search those and pull up articles relevant to this case. And long story short, it was involved in a civil asset forfeiture or a seizure by the U.S. Marshals in connection with a criminal investigation related to drug trafficking, alleged drug trafficking. And not only this Porsche, but a Nautique boat and an extreme boat trailer and a number of other things, houses and houses and cash and Rolex watches.
There's a
and,
gold bar on here.
Yes. Yeah. $2 million in cash was seized.
Whoa.
Yep. So, I think around $8 million is what we added it up to in assets were seized in connection with this investigation. So goodness. I thought, oh, well, this just took an odd turn. And of course, when I found all this stuff, I was like, well, I'm not sure if I want to get involved with this transaction, but I'm going to keep digging because, again, everything is alleged. People are innocent until they're proven guilty. I've had personally, I've been subpoenaed by the FBI on behalf of a client that they were investigating, thinking he was doing essentially like money laundering, credit fraud, whatever. And it turns out he just was so addicted to cars and was buying them and flipping them so quickly and always financing them to the hilt that they thought he was doing a scheme, and he wasn't. So they went through all this thing, subpoenaed everything, and then just dropped the case. Nothing ever became of it. So obviously I wanted to dig into this. Spoiler alert. I'm not sure what the conclusion is. There's a lot out there, but let's look at the article. There's a bunch of articles out there. We're referencing ClevelandJewishNews.com for one of these articles. And this is talking about a raid on Tibor's kosher meats and houses associated with it. The U.S. Attorney's Office received permission to sell several houses, including the Moreland Hills home of Eaton Sanders, the owner of Tibor's
Sanders.
Meats. Sanders, thank you.
Be careful.
Four different homes and a vacant residential property in Greater Cleveland, as well as a house in Los Angeles, are to be sold by the U.S. Marshals Service as part of an ongoing civil forfeiture case related to a THC vape cartridge manufacturer and distributor.
The weeds.
The so-called interlocutory sale is being done in the midst of a civil forfeiture case involving Justin Belay and Sanders, not necessarily as a means to settle it, or the parallel criminal investigation by the Federal Major Drug Crimes Task Force, according to language in the September 22 motion filed by U.S. Assistant Attorney Henry F. DeBagas. Quote, the parties agree that the requested order will not affect any other aspect of this litigation. Now, the reason the car and all these properties are listed as defendants, I think, is because this was related to the order to the seizure and the order to sell them. Mm. Right. So in this article, they talk about how both parties agree that it's best to sell these items. So on the court case, Belay and Sanders and all these different LLCs that they have for their properties are listed as claimants. So they're essentially claiming the property, saying these properties are ours, because in a civil forfeiture thing, like, the government just takes the stuff because it's maybe used in connection of a crime, right? So we hear about these people that get pulled over, they allow a search, they have cash, and it's suspicious. And this stupid civil asset forfeiture law is on the books. It allows the cops to just take it because it could have been used in a crime or might be. And then they do the investigation later, and then the people are innocent, or they can't prove that the cash or whatever they seize was used in connection to a crime or was proceeds of a crime. And the people don't get their money back. And they have to hire attorneys and sue, and maybe later on down the road, they get a portion of it back, but it's not an automatic return. The civil asset forfeiture thing is a freaking scam. Unless, like, okay, it's actually used in a crime, but it's not like they have this escrow where they place it for safekeeping and oh, well, we didn't file any charges or you were found innocent, so you get all your stuff back. No, it's like gone. So anyway, it was sold off. And an important note in this article, no charges have been filed. $8 million of assets seized. No charges filed.
Odd.
So initially when I started doing my research, I'm going, man, I don't want to get involved in this deal. This guy's a criminal, whatever. Like, there's no way they would do all this investigation. The U.S. Marshals would be involved. All this stuff would be seized. Nobody would have $2 million in cash if it wasn't illegal, whatever. And I don't want my hands on dirty money. Well, then I start doing a bunch of research, and my research assistant is helping, and we can't find any charges anywhere. We can't find any prison sentences, any prison time. And we're like, I don't think anything came of this. They just took $8 million worth of stuff, sold it off, and like didn't find anything against these people. Now, that doesn't mean they were innocent, but there are no charges filed.
Weird.
Yeah.
Is that how they got the Porsche, this dealer?
Yes. The Porsche was sold off at a local U.S. Marshals auction, and the dealer got a tip that it was going to be there. It was definitely not the ideal place to sell a rare 993 Turbo and an awesome color combo.
Oh, my God, for a steal.
But yes, they did buy it there, and they still own it in their private collection. So yeah, this is it's a little bit scary because if you're sus, the feds could come in and take everything you own, and then you have to fight to get it back. And they may never, ever file charges. They might just give up the case, drop the charges, whatever. And they still have all your stuff. It's really kind of scary.
But a lot of these articles are alleging that some significant things were going on.
Well, like, but that's it seems the media, right? Because there's an investigation, and they're at least, I mean, they cover their butts and they say, you know, these are the charges, these are, you know, according to or whatever. They're not saying these people are criminals. They're just saying what is happening and what is alleged and what statements the feds have made. The feds, of course, the prosecutors assume everybody's guilty. So they're saying all this inflammatory stuff, saying, oh, this is involved in, you know, major drug trafficking. These LLCs are all used to launder money that are the proceeds of drug trafficking. And that's why they're buying these houses in these LLCs' name. And so the prosecutors are saying all these things right out, right? Because you can't sue the prosecutors for defamation of character or whatever. That's, these are things that, you know, qualified immunity or whatever it is. So the articles are just quoting what's said in the complaints and in the court documents. So if you look at all the articles, you'd think, oh boy, these guys are all criminals. But again, what were we talking about in our last segment? There's no follow-up. There's no article out there going, oh, look, all this happened. No charges were filed. I wonder if civil asset forfeiture is really such a good thing. You know, these people's names are ruined and everybody associated with it. Maybe they are shady. Who knows? But they weren't charged with anything. And there's too many stories. Obviously, this is a big deal. This is $8 million. Maybe the prosecutors, maybe the feds did have something to go on. They just weren't able to build enough of a case to make the charges stick, so they gave it up. But there's too many cases of innocent people having their cash stolen from them by cops who in many departments will get a kickback from the feds just for seizing the funds, because the funds go to the feds. But in one department in Arizona, I don't remember if it's the state or the sheriff's or whatever, how it works. I think the local department that seizes it gets 80% of the money they seized as a kickback.
Wow.
So they're incentivized to seize cash. And then the feds have to like make the charges stick or whatever. I don't think there's any chargeback for the local department if they seize it wrongly. Yeah. They just get a big friggin' bonus for taking people's money.
Seems like there's a... I got questions.
There's a lot of questions here and not a lot of answers. There's a lot of stuff out there. But anyway. Speaking of trafficking, that brings us to our shrewd negotiator of the week. It's people trying really hard to make incredible deals typically, and they might trip over themselves in their negotiations. And especially with the new 992.2 GT3 coming out, we've seen a lot of people on the internet looking to sell kidneys in order to get this car. It's a common thing we see on the internet. Man, that car's awesome. Maybe I can sell a kidney.
I have had Instagram reels fed to me through the algorithm of people Googling the price of a kidney. And I'm like, it's not like you're going to your Target to hawk a kidney. Like,
because they were looking at our show notes. That's what it was. Scary. There's a PSA here. Okay. Organ trafficking is illegal. Selling kidneys, you can't do that. It's not a thing. I know some of you may be joking, but I'm not sure. You sound serious. You need to know that organ trafficking is highly illegal, something you could go to jail for. So you definitely shouldn't be selling your kidneys to go buy a car.
Especially for a 992.
Well, it's different. Like, yeah, maybe for 997 RX.
Yeah, like, okay, now we're
might
talking.
Might be worth the jail time. This episode is brought to you by Sheffield All Sport Watches. The Sheffield brand was recently revived by Jay Turkbus, an owner of an original Sheffield All Sport diver he received from his parents in 1970 when he was just 11, beginning his love of watches. As an adult, Jay used his extensive expertise in product development and marketing to revive the brand that started it all. He set out to develop watches with a high level of quality and specification at a value price. His first effort, and a successful one in July of 2023, was the debut of the Sheffield All Sport Diver 1. It had the kind of build and movement that much more expensive watches use, and his debut price of $108 was equivalent to the $13 his parents paid back in 1970. Since that debut, Sheffield has expanded to a wider range of automatics and chronos, many designed around vintage Sheffield dials of the 60s. The Sheffield well of clever and unique design remains his inspiration, as well as maintaining the goal of high quality, very affordable range of automatic and quartz watches. Sheffield watches, value on merit, not just price. I love mine. Get yours at SheffieldWatches.com and mention that you heard about them on Switchcast. All right, in the world of entertain, educate, and edify, this is an educational segment, and we want to touch on some of the questions that you should ask a dealer when you're purchasing a car, and ones that you shouldn't. And this is different from the ones that we've covered before, like, you know, how many owners does a car have? Where did the car reside? We're talking about like negotiation tactics and how you get the information you want the best. And of course, this was spurred by, silly questions that I get coming in and just bang my head against the wall going, why are you asking that? That doesn't help you out. And it really doesn't help me out either. So again, this is for entertainment, but also to help people out in terms of when you're buying a car, how do you best get to the bottom of what you really want to know? One of the first questions, car dealers hate this question, new car dealers anyway. What is the invoice?
Ah.
Right?
What is that, Doug? What is the invoice?
The invoice, theoretically, is the price that the dealer paid to the manufacturer. Now, the last 4 years, this really hasn't been a question because the market has been over sticker. So, like, asking that is completely irrelevant, but it's starting to come back. And prior to 2020, that was definitely a negotiation point, right? People were negotiating from invoice versus from sticker.
I mean, with the way the Z06 market's going, they might be able to start asking that question here pretty soon.
You are correct. However, the invoice is not typically the actual cost that the dealer pays the manufacturer, and it doesn't matter anyway. The old salesman response is, well, do you go into McDonald's and ask them what they paid for a hamburger?
I've truly never understood. The dealer needs to make money. Like, the people that seem to think that they can go into a dealer and just, like, get the car for what they paid, it's kind of wild.
Right, right. Yeah. You should be doing your homework and comparing other comparable vehicles, but work off of sticker price and other comp cars and say, like, okay, well, what is my deal relative to another vehicle at another dealer that's the same?
Yeah.
Compare apples to apples. I recognize people want to use the invoice as a point from negotiation, but just use the sticker price.
That's like asking a private party you're trying to deal with, well, what did you pay?
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
No, it really doesn't matter. What is market value? Asking, do you have service history? Now, every
but
time
that's
I
a good
ask
question.
A deal, yeah, you're right, but it isn't. Every corporate dealer I deal with now, they're so afraid of privacy violations that they'll just send you the Carfax. Default answer, well, it's on Carfax. Here's the Carfax. So they're not actually going to send you the service history. It's too much work. It's too much work. A small independent dealer might take the time to redact the records, scan them in, stuff like that. But it never, never works. The better question would be, can I see a copy of the inspection or service done in-house?
Okay.
Right? Because then you know, like, what's recent and what's relevant. And if they haven't done any of that, well, then maybe you need to do some more due diligence.
Well, and I think too, you know, obviously having a robust service history is really important if you're going for like a blue chip car or something that has great provenance. But I also think that, you know, you want to see that it's been taken care of.
Sure.
I think that's an important thing. But also at the end of the day, if it's had its oil change, fluids changed and stuff done like recently when it should have been, probably fine.
Sure. And we're talking more in generalities. Normal cars here, not necessarily the super specialty cars. Yes, you want service history on the specialty cars, but the absence of a physical service history doesn't mean it was serviced. I'd rather see a comprehensive inspection report because you could test the moisture content on the brake fluid. You could have zero receipts for the brake fluid being replaced, but if the moisture content is less than 1%, you know it was replaced.
It's good to go.
Yeah. Here's a great one. What's your best price?
Well, the one on the website there, kiddo.
Pretty much. Yeah. You're never going to get a good answer from a dealer on that. So stop asking it. Just make them an offer. Yeah. Here's a good one. What does the car need / does the car need anything?
You know, so this wasn't with the dealer, but I asked that question on a particular website with the Corvette Pace car that I currently own. Said needs nothing. Tires were replaced whenever, yada, yada. Guess what happened when I got the car in, Doug? Tires were from 2002.
Yep.
So old.
And it needed a whole bunch of other things.
So many, all the fluids needed replaced, whole business. So it needed a lot. The car was fine. Nothing dramatic, but to be roadworthy, to do what I wanted it to do, needed a bunch of stuff.
Yep. Yep. Well, and the fundamental principle here is it's not the dealer's job to tell you the bad. It's to tell you the good. So it's up to you to find out yourself what it does need or what's wrong with it. Now, you could do that. You can look at it yourself. You could have a third-party inspection done, and that's a better question, right? Can I have a third-party inspection done? Any good, transparent dealer will allow that with certain contingencies. But that's a way better question than what does the car need? You're assuming the salesman even knows. Half the salesmen haven't the faintest idea. Well, the tread's fat on the tires, but they're 20 years old.
When I was looking for my 996, I went to go test drive a couple, and one of them, the salesman was so upfront because I wanted to take it for a test drive, and they let me do that. And he's like, yeah, honestly, you know more about this car than I do. It just showed up yesterday. I was like, all right, guy doesn't know what's going on.
What's my monthly payment?
Ugh.
Do not ever, ever, ever negotiate based on monthly payment. The dealer wants you to ask that question because then they can hide all the rest of the numbers. Oh, it's $400 a month on a 30-year term. Specific questions. What is the price of the car? What are your dealer fees? What is the total out-the-door price with taxes and dealer fees? Give me an itemized list. What is my trade-in credit? What is the actual value of my trade-in? Get all the numbers, add them up yourself, make sure they make sense. What is my interest rate? Ask that question. What is the term of my loan? What are the bank fees? Get everything itemized. Look at it. Make it make sense to you. Do not ask what your monthly payment should be because that just gives, that is the question salesmen love to hear.
Well, and I like that if you do some of your homework ahead of time and you come in prepared and you have yourself pre-approved for some financing so that you have an idea of a rate and a term and everything else, plug for PenFed, you have a potential bargaining chip. You can say, I'm already good to go. I've got this financing ready to buy this car if I want it as is. If the dealership can provide you better financing with a better rate, go for it.
Sure.
But you at least are, like you have pointed out, you're talking about the numbers. You know what you are paying out the door and after the term of the loan for the car.
Absolutely.
What's another question?
Can you send more info?
If they had more info, wouldn't that be presented? This isn't a Facebook Marketplace listing. Ideally.
No, there's a lot of generic write-ups on dealer websites, which are ridiculous. But from the dealer perspective of things, when I get that question, I'm just like, what do you want to know? And it runs the gamut. sometimes people literally ask me the most basic things. Well, how many miles? What are you asking for it? What color is it? I've gotten that. What color is it? I'm like, did you not see the listing?
What?
From a customer perspective, what the heck are you asking? I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've responded to these inquiries going, sure, I'd be happy to. What information would you like? Nothing. No response.
So weird.
Now, the better thing to ask is what you actually want to know, right? So as a dealer, and I think most salesmen, we make fun of these people on our dealer pages. We get the numbered checklists of very specific questions that people want. It's, oh, here comes the know-it-all. Like, this is the guy that's going to come in New Balances and look underneath the car. Well, there's a reason. It's because the salesmen slash the dealers don't give the customer the information that they want. But know what information you actually want. Like, honestly, I'll take the checklist person almost any day over the generic, can you send more information? Because at least then there's a clear path forward. There's easy, maybe not easy, but there's direct answers to direct questions. I know exactly what I need to provide to the customer in order to get a deal or not get a deal. I don't want anything hanging out there of like, well, is this guy real or is he not? Or I don't even know. So yeah, I'll take the numbered checklists anytime. But the real, what that point is really illustrating is, like all of these questions, don't ask kind of vague, open-ended questions. Get specific. Know what you actually want to know. And that may require doing a little bit of extra homework beforehand, but know what you want to know and ask the dealer those pointed questions.
Well, and I have run into an issue, and Doug, I'm curious of your thoughts. I've not bought many cars. I've bought a handful. But for the most part, when I call the dealer or I talk to the owner, as long as the car is what I think it is, I'm ready to buy. And I don't know if that's a common scenario. So I have very specific questions, but I find that because I'm already at this point, I feel like I just need to have somebody else look at it, to like a PPI, to like make sure it's not a piece of garbage. Mm-hmm. Like, would it be like, how do you start the conversation? Because I almost find myself grasping at straws. Is it just... Sure. Because I don't want to ask these vague questions. I want to seem serious and interested.
Well, you're also a highly informed buyer, right? And we're talking about specialty cars with you.
That's
right?
True.
On a run-of-the-mill car, Toyota Camrys are commodities, right? There's nothing really that makes one car significantly better than the next, unless there's crazy things like a rebuilt title or something like that. I think for a lot of people, they just want a conversation. They want to start a conversation. And there's the art of sales, right? Is they just want to talk about what they've already read online. They just want to feel better about it. They want to be reassured by the salesman that the things that they read online are true. Whether or not they actually are is a totally different story.
That's true.
But honestly, as a buyer, that is not the best tack to take. You want to know what you actually want to know. If you don't know, then fine. Just ask random questions. Yeah. But ask those specific questions. Don't ask questions with assumptions that you're going to get what you want to know. Don't ask open-ended questions. Make the dealer provide you what you actually need to know. And if they don't, then get it yourself. Have third-party inspections done. Do the other things necessary in order to satisfy yourself with the condition of the car so that you can buy it. Same thing with negotiations, with pricing. Again, going back, do your research, know what your interest rate should be, know what the price of the car should be. Don't expect the dealer to provide you with that information. They're there to sell you the car. That's totally fine. It's not their job to inform you and educate you and get you to the point of, they just want to sell you the car. So ask the questions you really, really want to know. Speaking of car dealers, that brings us to the props and flops. Brought to you by our favorite car dealer, Switch Cars.
You might be biased, but I guess I am too. Switch Cars is the enthusiast dealership where we buy, sell, and consign only cars that we'd like ourselves. Check out our handpicked inventory at switchcars.com and mention SwitchCast for special pricing. Find more information at switchcars.com or come visit our showroom in beautiful Twinsburg, Ohio. Especially beautiful this time of year. Goodness, the trees are fantastic.
They are.
Love the evening, early evening drives.
Pick of the week this week is a 2013 BMW E92 M3. That's a coupe, for those of you that don't know the lingo. Competition package, which means it has different wheels.
Yeah.
White over tan interior, 55,000 miles, nicely serviced. We will provide you the service records that we have if you ask, but we might tell you they're on Carfax. And we do have an in-house service receipt and inspection and paint meter readings and all those specific things, underside photos that you would want. But don't ask us for more info. Ask us specifically for the things that you want to know.
How long have you had the car, Doug? Why are you selling it?
It doesn't matter. That is funny when people don't realize that we're a dealer and they yeah. ask us those types of private party questions. Yeah. Why yeah. are you selling it? To pay the bills,
yeah.
to feed my family, we're a friggin' car dealer. Our flop of the week, a McLaren locally catches on fire. The owner attempts to put it out by popping the engine cover, which isn't a good start unless you have a fire extinguisher handy.
Usually where the fire's at, if I've got to be right. honest.
Right, yes, but popping the engine cover sucks air into
ooh, oxygen,
the engine yes. bay, right? Uh-huh, yeah, uh-huh. So you never want to just be like, whoop, and open the engine cover. Anyway, so he pops the engine cover and tries to blow on it to put it out.
It could have been a big birthday candle. He was just really, he thought it was one of those joke ones that just doesn't go out.
Yeah, I gave him a lot of crap for that. I'm like, you know, that's what I do in my, like, on my bonfire to get the fire going more. Yes. Because there's oxygen in our breath, and
I mean, it's kind of amazing. Like, it must have been terrified. Obviously, car on fire is a huge thing. Adrenaline's running. You're not really thinking straight. You're like, "Bah, blow out candles." But yeah, you know, when you blow a campfire, it gets bigger. So you just step away from the vehicle.
Yeah. And I think he then got like a bottle of water from someone and tried to pour that on it, which nice. It's either an electrical or a chemical fire with a car, so that isn't a good idea either. I'll give him a pass there, but blowing on it. Oh boy. Our prop of the week, Arnie Toman, who is known internationally for driving long distances at a very high rate of speed, has completed a different endurance challenge. He walked 50 miles in one day.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
That is significant.
It absolutely is. Our friend Ed Bullion said he's not sure if... no, sorry. Fix this in post. Our friend Dave Maher, fellow cannonballer, said that he's not sure he will walk 50 miles cumulatively for the rest of his life, nor does he have interest in doing so. And he's a fit dude.
Yeah, seriously.
Arnie averaged 3 miles an hour on this trek, which is only 100 miles an hour short of his cannonball record speed.
Ah, he's got some time to make up.
Yes. Yeah, just a wee bit. And he did take an extra pair of shoes with him this time. That's an Easter egg for those of you that know about our cannonball story. He thought that was overkill on the cannonball because he wanted to pack light, but... Mm. I think he left a pair of shoes at his aunt's house, which was about the midpoint. So he nice. Swapped out shoes. And to me, this was would have been a soul-sucking exercise.
Oh, okay. All right. That's fine.
But I think he left a pair of shoes there so he didn't have to do any soul-searching on his way. Yeah.
Was this on the heel of any other adventure he had going on?
Good one. Good one. Sneaker. I barely know her.
Ethan, end it quick.
I don't know what my shoes have been laced with, but I've been tripping all day.
Oh, God, they're devolving.
Thank you for joining us for Switchcast with Doug Tabbitt and Tyler Sanders, produced by Ethan Huffnagel. Switchcast is an automotive entertainment and opinion show, and nothing we say should be taken very seriously. We do not give tax, investment, legal, emotional, or professional advice, and the only licenses we hold are driver's licenses. The opinions expressed on this show are exclusively held by the people pontificating at that moment and do not reflect the values of our producers or sponsors. Our theme music is provided by Emily and Ivory. You can stream their full album on Spotify or SoundCloud. If you like this show, you can stream it in its entirety on your favorite audio podcast platform. Check out switchcast.live for more info.